Hey, good afternoon, Juno. It's 3 minutes and 21 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the middle of our pledge drive, and while we're introducing Juno Afternoon, please call 586-3636, or if you're out of town, 1-800-478-3636, or if you're online, go on to www.ktoo.org and pledge your support for public radio. Today on Juno Afternoon, we have a really nice list of guests. Folks will be dropping in along here to tell us about the College Track 3 premiere film that's going on up on campus tonight. We'll get a preview of a concert at Northern Light Church called The Art of the Harp. Hopefully the artists of the harp will be here. Tracy Taylor will drop in to tell us about a production of the Vagina Monologues by students at UAS. And we'll learn about tonight's presentation of the UAS League and Library Lecture Hall on Attitudes Regarding Wolves with guest Dr. Alex Simon. We'll get underway with all of those guests in just a moment. But right now, 5 minutes of National Native News.
For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Representative Kevin Cramer says comments he made about reservation safety during a recent meeting with tribal officials in Bismarck, North Dakota, have been misconstrued, although he is now apologizing for his tone. On Tuesday, Cramer allegedly told victim assistance professionals that he would not feel safe on reservations because of new provisions in the Violence Against Women Act. According to Spirit Lake Nation Victim Assistance Director Melissa Merrick, Cramer went on to say that tribal courts were dysfunctional and a non-Native person could not get a fair trial on a reservation. He allegedly also stated that he wanted to wring the tribal council's neck and slam them against the wall. New provisions under the Violence Against Women Act give tribal authorities the ability to prosecute non-Natives for crimes committed on tribal land. The North Dakota Republican disputes that he used the word dysfunctional and says he's trying to arrange a conversation with Merrick to apologize for the misunderstanding. However, the U.S. representative from North Dakota has yet to address the neck-wringing allegation. Cramer was one of a handful of Republicans who voted to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act last month. The Cherokee Nation and its economic arm, Cherokee Nation Businesses, announced the largest healthcare capital investment in the tribe's history yesterday. As Kerry Young reports, this is the first major investment Cherokee businesses have made directly into tribal infrastructure.
The Cherokee Nation will be investing more than $100 million in the tribe's healthcare system. Included in the expansion plan is the addition of a new 100-bed hospital, 2 new health centers, and the expansion of another. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Bill John Baker says investing in the healthcare system is the right thing to do and will provide savings on multiple fronts.
So we really believe that there's going to be a great deal of savings, not only in human suffering, but in dollars for the Cherokee Nation by being able to provide these services early and often. In this economy, healthcare is more important to our people than anything else.
Officials say an additional benefit of the project is that the tribe's construction company, Cherokee Nation Construction Resources, will be serving as the prime contractor. The experience will earn them past performance credits, an important credential for future government and commercial contracting. Construction of the new facilities is expected to begin this spring. For National Native News, I'm Carrie Young.
The Navajo Nation has won another battle against Urban Outfitters. A federal judge denied the fashion retailer's motion to dismiss the case. This will allow the Navajo Nation to proceed with its trademark infringement complaint. Urban Outfitters sold products under the name Navajo, including a Navajo liquor flask and Navajo hipster panties. At the heart of the lawsuit is the Indian Arts and Crafts Act, which makes it illegal to produce products that make connections to Native culture but are not made by a Native artisan or tribe. The Navajo Nation says the use of the Navajo name by Urban Outfitters gives the appearance that Navajos played some role in the production of the products. Urban Outfitters argues that neither clothing or clothing accessories fall under the categories of arts or crafts when viewed through the Indian Arts and Crafts Act. Judge Leroy Hansen disagreed and denied the company's motion to dismiss. And Taos Pueblo fashion designer Patricia Michaels will be heading to the next episode of Project Runway. Michaels is the first Native designer to appear on the show and is one of 5 designers left, with only 2 episodes remaining until the season finale. Michaels has repeatedly won praise for her work on the program and has managed to survive the competition despite not yet winning a challenge. The show airs on Lifetime every Thursday evening. On this day in 2012, tribal and federal officials celebrated the Port Gamble Sklallam Tribe's foster care and adoption program. The Washington Tribe became the first tribe in the country to receive federal approval to run its own Title IV-E program. The tribe now manages all social services under Title IV of the Social Security Act, including child welfare, child support, child care, and temporary assistance to needy families. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM, Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Just about 9.5 minutes after 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first guest, everybody knows Pat Race, is here to talk about a film that he's fairly recently finished, I think, that is going to be premiered tonight. And this is the third film in a series of films. Pat didn't work on the first two, I guess, but this is your first time out with this College Track series, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Hello?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, there we go. This is something that we were brought in to work on by Katie Bosler, who works out at the university, and she was involved in the first two iterations of the College Track series, and it was a project that I believe started as a nationwide movement to look at different groups of people and see how the college experience was shaping up for them, and what a Western education meant and how to examine it. So what they focused on here in Juneau was what does it mean to be like a rural student coming in and attending a university, and what does that look like? So they followed some students around and documented them and tried to tell their stories and some of the unique challenges they faced and some of the interesting experiences they had as they attended school.
Well, now there's one lady, Amanda Bremner Porter, who actually has now finished her degree in 2011. But she was in all three of these programs, so it's a kind of a way to follow her career, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and that must be kind of interesting from her perspective. I know that some of her friends referred to the previous, I think it was the second College Track film. They called it Mandy Track. It was, yeah. It's really interesting to interview a student so early on in their career, and then come back and revisit that and see if they've, if they've lived up to their own expectations, if they've done what they said they were going to do, if their plans have wildly changed. And knowing students, things change. It's, and life throws a lot at you. So it's really interesting to see how you think maybe a university experience might go, and then just see what happens along the way.
You mentioned this was a nationwide program, but the films are actually local to the area. So what does your film tell us about the college experience for Alaska Natives?
Yeah, so our film we followed around, it was about five students that we really focused on, and we just tried to document their experience, what they were trying to get out of college, and what interacting with the university was like for them. And what we really discovered was that there are, coming out of small communities in Alaska, there are so many ties to a community. There are so many community obligations, cultural obligations, family obligations, that coming to the big city and trying to get a college degree is a huge challenge, and you're constantly being pulled back into your community, and you need to respect that. And so one of the things that we saw was that all the students that we documented were phenomenal. The things that they accomplished over the time that we were able to observe them was just amazing. They put up the totem pole out there at the university while they're going to class, and they raised a bunch of money for it, and they're learning their language. Oftentimes, languages that are dying or have very few people who speak them. One of the students we followed is learning the Haida language, which had at that time had fewer than 10 known speakers. And the stresses that they face, the obligations that they feel to that cultural, to that language, to preserving it. It was really interesting to see that cast in the light of a, like a Western education. You know, so it's a really tough balance trying to live up to like cultural aspirations and obligations while trying to fit into this mold of what it means to be a college student in this century.
How did you actually go into villages with students who were called back?
Yeah, it was great. We filmed in Yakutat and Heidelberg, and we spoke to a lot of students who were from other areas of Alaska, and I feel like we got a pretty good idea of what that experience was like. And there are a lot of programs that help students coming in, and there are a lot of good scholarship opportunities. And sometimes it's hard to just get the word out about those. So I think this film is something that we wanted to aim at not just the teachers or the administrators, but at students who might be able to learn something from it about what opportunities might be out there for them, and also prepare them for what kind of challenges they might be facing.
It's much more common now that a portion of almost any college student's college curriculum is taught by what are called e-learning courses, but that became a topic in this study as well, because it enabled some of the students who had to be at home for extended periods to continue their educations, because UAS is so heavily invested in electronic education, I think.
Yeah, yeah, and actually one of the students that we talked about, Amanda, spent a lot of time in Yakutat doing distance education and working to document Tlingit names and to preserve the language there and to learn the language from the elders that are in the community. And she did a lot of that because now they're able to do so much distance education.
Now, UAS has had to actually put entire degree programs online in order to be able to reach the state, the Southeast Alaska population. But by doing that, they reach a much broader population as well.
The one thing we really bumped up against in this film is that there's this idea that a college degree is something you get over 4 years. And there's even a big push right now by the university to, you know, like get your degree in 4 years. You know, is this idea that we have, and it's part of this kind of a Western education.
And no, it's part of it. Actually, it's pressure from statistics.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Universities are measured for their success by their 4-year graduation rate.
Right.
And that measure has had. It has a great deal of meaning for traditional college freshmen who come out of high school, go immediately into college, and finish in 4 years. But for the rest of the world, that statistic is not really a very good measure of the quality of an educational institution.
I feel like in Alaska, more so. I went to school up in Fairbanks, and a lot of the people I knew up there were not getting their degrees in 4 years. And a lot of people that were accomplishing some pretty amazing things were not getting their degrees in 4 years and feeling guilty about it. And so I think that's something I wanted to challenge, is this notion that to be a good student, you have to graduate in 4 years.
Pat, very quickly, we're almost out of time. What will happen tonight at 7 o'clock?
Tonight at 7 o'clock, there will be a screening. It's a film that's about a half hour long, and it documents these students' lives and experiences. And then we're going to have a few folks on hand to do kind of a roundtable discussion. And then we'll open it up for questions and answers.
And is this in the which room?
At the Egan Lecture Hall.
At the Egan Lecture Hall.
Yeah, on the U.S.
campus. Screen and a great place to watch film.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Pat.
Yeah, thank you.
harp music in the background is indicative of the fact that we are going to have a harpist as a guest here in Juneau. We have a harpist, two of them, as guests here in Juneau. They're doing a concert at Northern Light Church this Saturday, I guess, right?
Tomorrow night.
So the people who you were listening to, actually, there's a third person on that cut, I think. But this is Portia Dewa, who is here, and Diana Stork.
Hi.
So you're up from the Bay Area?
Mm-hmm. San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I said the two of you have been playing together for a long time, and then you told me an interesting story about how Portia came to be in that.
Portia was my student, came to me when she was age 9. She's now turned 30, and she's been off on her own, and, you know.
You can kick her if you don't want her telling your age on the radio.
Well, don't tell my age. Playing around in the Bay Area for years and years and years. She was always, you know, very, very precocious, and the harp was always her path. I could see that right away as a harp teacher. I can really recognize people who are just playing it for the fun of it or the beauty of it or the quote-unquote magic of it. But then those who, you know, who have all those aspects, but, you know, start running their scales and, you know, start composing and start wanting to share the music. It's been a gorgeous road with Portia, and I was so happy to be able to bring her up here. This is her first time in Alaska, and she's been, like, astounded how beautiful and magic this place is.
Sometimes you wake up in the morning and there are mountains, you know. Mm-hmm. But then you took the thing a different direction. If I'm right, you kind of drew her into a project that you started to bring the harp down to folks who were a little less advantaged than the rest of us.
Diana and I were directing a mission harp ensemble project in San Francisco to bring harp music to the children who don't usually have harp music in their, or any music in their schools. So teaching on small harps that were specially donated to the Multicultural Music Fellowship that Diana directs. And that was a very, you know, rewarding project to bring Latin American harp music to the children on these small harps.
Yeah. So when you come up to do a harp concert, you must bring several large instruments with you, right?
Normally we do, but we've been hit. Musicians have been hit so hard with the price of gas and what they're doing now in the airports, where they're just charging for everything. Every single bag is being charged for, let alone, you know, a 25-pound harp with a big, you know, big case, anvil case. So we took a big leap of faith, actually, this time, and through the internet, hallelujah, we just made a bunch of calls, made a bunch of emails, and connected with some harp players. There's a harp group here called the C-Tones.
Yes.
In fact, we gave a workshop to them last night, and two of the women in the C-Tones lent us their harps, and they described them carefully and the kind of stringing, and we knew the harp makers. But it was a real leap of faith. You know, we came in off the airport, and my sister, we've been staying with Liz Saya and Greg McLaughlin, president of the Alaska Folk Fest, we've been staying with them. They had picked up the harps beforehand. The first thing we do, unzip the cases, and, wow, it was a big, huge sigh of relief. They're very, very nice harps. Nice harps. Mm-hmm. We're really lucky. We have to do a bunch of work on the sharpening levers and everything to get them, you know, the intonation right. Because one of them hadn't been played for a couple of years. And
I'm not sure if you know, but the kind of harps that we're playing are called lever harps, or otherwise known as Celtic harps. But they can have different string tensions, and these ones have light string tension strung with Savarez strings, which is very similar to the harps that we have back at home. So it was easy to transition from the harps that we have at home to here, luckily.
Yeah, and that's not, because I played a tour down in Hawaii, and then this harp I played was like I'd be like a football player to play it. The string tension was really high, and it must have been about 80 pounds, this harp. It was like, you know, anyway, I was happy to have it, but anyway, it has been a real challenge now touring with harps. So we were really, really, really lucky. But these harps are beautiful, the ones that we're going to be playing tomorrow night.
Well, what you're going to find if you wander any deeper into that situation at all is that Juneau has a totally unique cultural village here.
It does.
It it swells out of so many different directions that we have a wonderful little theater group called Perseverance that plays world premieres and stuff like that.
Juno Symphony, I was just noticing that it's on your 50 years.
Yeah.
And somebody just told me that you actually have, one of the women last night said that you have acquired your own pedal harp, so you have a harp here in Juneau.
I'm thinking it has to do with the fact that we're geographically isolated. I mean, if we don't do it, then, we're lucky to have someone come up to us like you're doing here.
Well, we always
want a workshop when you come.
But, you know, there are a lot of people that are isolated that don't have as much culture. It's amazing the culture you have here. I mean, you could do something every night.
We were impressed. We were just at Glacier View School, and they had a really great music program. We saw all these instruments, 10 guitars on the wall and
cellos,
20 and drums.
Yeah, we can sing along over there.
Every student
in that mm-hmm. thing has to learn to play a stringed instrument.
Yeah, they were very, very
And they were really, admiring the harps that we brought to play for them, history of the harp lecture.
And then they've exported that to the rest of the schools in the system. So now schools that had kind of nascent music programs are beginning to catch on to those. So
it's wonderful. Yeah. Lori Hagee was the woman that we worked with, She's an extraordinary woman, really.
I had the joy of working with Lori this last winter. I sang in King Island Christmas. She was our pianist for most of our performances. She is amazing on the piano.
Well, anyway, she's an amazing teacher, though.
So what are we going to hear tonight, or tomorrow?
Let's see. Okay. Well, we both of us are in love with the music from South America, the harp music from South America, Latin harp music. So you'll be hearing some of that.
Celtic music.
You're going to be hearing a number of original compositions that are inspired by pieces that we have written, inspired by different world traditions. I have a classical background, but for years and years I've been doing a lot of different world music. I mean, I've traveled to different countries in order to study the music. We have some African influences in our music, as well as Paraguayan, Mexican, Venezuelan, some Indian influences, Indian, North Indian classical Hindustani ragas. I was in the harp orchestra of Ali Akbar Khan, the Maihar Orchestra, so I still do that, but that was a big amount of time spent studying the ragas with Ali Akbar Khan, the great sarod player. So a lot of influences. Let's see, we've had so many different programs, we're doing so many different repertoires of different programs. It's like, what are we doing tomorrow? And I said, Portia, we got to practice. We got to, like, what are we playing tomorrow night? I mean, we know what we're playing, but I haven't had my hands on that material for a week.
Kind of our theme was California Celtic, of what we wanted to bring
how we
put our own arrangements and modern twist on these traditional music from South America and Ireland. They're pieces that we love, and then for example, Aravata, beautiful piece, but Diana plays in a blues style, or taking a piece like Scarborough Fair, but playing it in kind of a jazzy way. So we try to do something, to make it personally our own.
We sort of can't help it.
You also do a little composition.
Both of us do a lot of composing. Mm-hmm. I have about 8 books out of original compositions. Mm. But it has been the last. We were part of a trio called Triskella, which is 3 harps.
That was the group we heard at the beginning.
From the Voice of Tara CD. Mm-hmm. And we were so sorry we couldn't bring Sean up with us. She just couldn't break away, couldn't get the time, and I don't think we could found 3 harps up here, but we do a lot of composing, and it's sort of something that's very close to, it's something we can't not do. But you'll hear our great respect for these different traditions always in what is, like, this piece, Wedding Bells. You were mentioning that earlier. That one, you can distinctly hear some, Venezuelan. There's a tradition called Arpa Llanera, or the Harp of the Plains, which is from the sort of just below Caracas. And it has this distinctive kind of a bass pattern that you'll definitely hear in that one, as well as da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which has a little classical one of the sections. And then we do the kind of interlacing patterns, which sounds a little bit like African chora music. We do polyrhythmic things.
Well, you're making me hungry to hear the harp, so
Okay. We shall.
But first we need to make sure that everyone knows that tomorrow night at 7:30, right, at Northern Light United Church is the Art of the Harp. Diana Stork, Portia Duma, they will be on stage bringing us some of this music that we've been talking about for the last several minutes. Thank you so much for making the trip.
Thank you.
Welcome to Alaska for your first time. We'll see you again and again and again and again and again and again and again. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 29th of March, 2013. It's the birthday of the poet R.S. Thomas, born Cardiff, Wales, 1913, Anglican clergyman, Welsh nationalist, though he didn't learn the Welsh language until he was 30, wrote his poetry in English, but his autobiography in Welsh. He called it Neb, meaning nobody. He was a Luddite. He and his wife lived in a little stone cottage, no refrigerator, no washing machine. He said, "A recurring ideal, I find, is that of simplicity. At times there comes the desire to write with great precision and clarity words so simple and moving that they bring tears to the eyes." It's the birthday of Emmy Sedaris, born Endicott, New York, 1961, grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina. Author of two satirical homemaking books, I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence, and Simple Times, Crafts for Poor People. Amy Sedaris, who said in an interview about the Sedaris family, "We read everything we can about diseases and physical deformity. We were so protected in North Carolina. There's a place here in New York where you can get antique skin disorder books in color. They're really beautiful photographs." It's the birthday of Alexandra Fuller, born in Glossop, England, 1969, grew up in Zimbabwe. In 2002, published her memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, the story of her life as the child of white settlers caught up in a civil war in Mozambique. By the time she was 7 years old, Fuller knew how to strip, clean, load, and fire a machine gun. She also knew never to sneak into her parents' bedroom at night in case they mistook her for an intruder. Published another memoir called Cocktail Hour, Under the Tree of Forgetfulness, in which she tells the story of her mother, born in Scotland, raised in Kenya. It's the birthday of Eugene McCarthy, poet and politician, born in Watkins, Minnesota, 1916. And it's the birthday of Judith Guest, born in Detroit, 1936. When she was in her 30s, she read a how-to book called One Way to Write Your Novel. And 3 years later, she published her first novel, Ordinary People. It was a bestseller in 1976, the story of the Jarrett family in Lake Forest, a suburb of Chicago, whose son Buck is drowned in a sailing accident on Lake Michigan, and whose brother Conrad, who was with him on the boat, attempts suicide. The movie won an Academy Award for Best Picture in 1980. Here's a poem for today by Robert Frost, Meeting and Passing. As I went down the hill along the wall, there was a gate I had leaned at for the view, and had just turned from when I first saw you as you came up the hill. We met, but all we did that day was mingle great and small footprints in summer dust, as if we drew the figure of our being less than two, but more than one as yet. Your parasol pointed the decimal off with one deep thrust, and all the time we talked, you seemed to see something down there to smile at in the dust. Oh, it was without prejudice to me. Afterward, I went past what you had passed before we met, and you what I had passed. Meeting and Passing by Robert Frost, from The Poetry of Robert Frost, published by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 24 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We are in the middle of a fund drive right now. We're on our pledge week. The last time I heard, we had about $700 to go, and so you could call right now at 586-3636, 7000, or 1-800-478-3636, or we'll go online at www.ktoo.org and pledge your support for public radio. My guests right now are pledging their support in different ways. They are coming to us to tell us about a live I had a little technical thing that I had to do there, so let me see if this will work. Yes. I have guests, and I have enough of them that I need four microphones all of a sudden. I had to change the condition of the board because I looked up and realized that I was only picking up three people. So with me in the studio are Tracy Taylor, Andrea Budbill, Heather Laverne, and Aaron Tripp, and the four ladies here, plus is there more in the cast?
There's absolutely. 16.
Yeah, there's 16 in the cast. They're going to do the Vagina Monologues this year. When are you doing it?
When?
Yeah, when?
It's on Saturday, March 30th, and March 31st, Sunday. And there are two shows on Saturday, 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and one on Sunday, 7 o'clock.
Where are you at?
Tomorrow and the next day.
We're at UAS Rec Center.
Yeah, the Rec Center. Okay, good. All right. So the monologues have been around, as we were talking just before we opened the mics, and I had a little trouble opening the mics. The monologues have been around since about 96. So I guess I have a couple of questions. One is that when Eve Ensler originally put them on stage, she performed them for a period of time, and then she started adding other voices. But then another project came out of that, and that's called V-Day. And I understand you're giving some of your money to V-Day. Now, V-Day normally is in the middle of February, right?
It is. It's usually February 14th, but she has a timeline, and we have until the second week of April to be able to perform and still donate to the V-Day.
I see. Okay. And so the other thing is that the monologues change. This is not the original 96 cast in stone and never changed at all. They decided to add a monologue a year, and you were saying that you get a set that is part of the thing. So Heather's the director. Tell us how that process worked for you.
Well, I've been a part of this show three times. This is my third time doing it, and every time they have a new monologue near the end, and usually they'll do a couple rewrites here and there just to modernize it a little bit for other monologues, but they just try to find something that is fitting for the time and the year and something that they can say that's going to be relevant and just add in a new monologue that's going to just speak to the audience of now. So
I guess the other question is, how did you all become involved in this thing? Did Heather walk down the hall saying, does anybody want to be in a play in a couple of months? Or
you know, that kind of happened a little bit. Tracy was the one who originated it. So
I was first introduced to the vagina monologues in a women's community college and was hooked. And when I transferred up here to UAS, I didn't see any vagina monologues going on, so I thought, oh, we need to try to get that happening. So we did one 2 years ago, and we're going to be able to get to do one tomorrow and the next day.
Mm-hmm. So the other two, had you had experience with this before?
This is my first time. I never actually seen the vagina monologues. Yeah, this is Erin. Hello.
Yeah.
How's it going? So this is my very first time being exposed to it, and it's been a very interesting experience. I didn't realize there was such a wide range of monologues. Like, mine is very, very heavy, and Andrea's is very lighthearted.
Uh-huh.
It's like the most lighthearted you could get in this play. We're like opposites.
Yeah, I had never seen the vagina monologues before either. I saw on HBO, I saw Eve Ensler's documentary, but that was the only exposure I'd had to it before, and I wasn't in town when they did it 2 years ago, so I didn't get to see it then either. And I haven't really done anything like this before, but friends with Heather, friends with Tracy, is sort of, you know, UAS is a small campus, so everybody hears about it, and just try it out. Not involved.
When Eve Ensler first produced this show, with a provocative title, to say the least, particularly in the stone cold 90s back then when we were all Puritans. The question is, now with almost 20 years on top of it, is the audience still likely to react with shock?
Yes.
The language alone will probably do that.
Sometimes. There's some things that might shock the audience. It depends on your audience, I think. Everyone walks out of it pretty happy, as far as I can tell from the past few that I've been to.
Uh-huh.
I think it's about making also, like, if you think about it, the title shouldn't be provocative. Like, it's not, it's just a word, you know, vagina is a name of a body part.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know why it's become such a bad word to people, but I think that part of the vagina monologues is making people comfortable with that kind of thing.
One of the critics, one of the strong criticisms that came out as the play continued to play was that it had a very strong lesbian twist to it. Do you find that in the current version?
There are a couple monologues that deal with that, but it comes at it from every angle. Almost every type of woman is represented in each mm-hmm. monologue. There's going to be a different dynamic for each one. And really, if I think about it, the lesbian topic is really only in one or two out of the, like, 14 monologues that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not really a huge thing, but the ones that have it, they're really well written, and they come at it from two different sides of it, and it's actually really, really cool.
I mean, there's a lot of different types. There's a 6-year-old girl monologue in there, and there's also a woman who watched her granddaughter being born. It's a lot of different mm-hmm. kinds of things in it.
So when you told your mothers that you were that you were going to be doing the vagina monologues this weekend, how did they react?
It was not so much my mom as my dad. It came more from my dad. I don't know what you can say on the air, but he thought that there should be a penis monologue.
that was suggested by the critics as well.
Yes, so it's a common response.
Yeah.
My mom's definitely a little bit shocked, but she's going to come watch it, and so is my godmother and a lot of their friends. My grandmother was actually very, very supportive. She doesn't live here, but I told her recently that I was in it, and she was really excited and proud of me. So.
And Heather, when you tell them this is your latest directing credit, how's that work?
My parents are super supportive. They saw me do this when I did it in my hometown about 4 years ago. And even though they were a little shy about coming in, they know that everything I do is just based on, you know, the fact that it's important to me. And so they don't really care what the topic is as long as I'm, you know, doing it to the best of my ability.
So we established before we opened the mics up that you're all seniors and you're all graduating this year. Is anybody a senior in the dramatic arts? I don't think they offer that degree out at UAS, do they?
Yeah, well, no. It's a BLA program degree, so I had to make my own because they offer the classes And I took some classes through UAA so that I could fulfill the requirements. But, yeah, I'm getting a theater degree.
Oh, okay.
And I'm also in another play. So.
What other play?
The Road Weeps, the Well Runs Dry.
Okay.
That's not. I feel like I shouldn't be plugging that.
Hey, cheap publicity.
Is that Perseverance?
Okay, no problem.
So anyway, right. So yeah, very busy.
Okay.
Very busy.
Good. Okay. Anybody else in anything else? Any other dramatic experience? Go ahead.
I don't know if it counts as dramatic. I don't know. Three of us are in Alaska Pella.
Oh, yeah.
We're an acapella choir at UAS. We have concerts coming up. I'm not going to talk about that. But,
well, you should come on. You should bring the group.
We will.
And we'll put you on the air with it.
Here. That's a really big group.
I know. I've heard them sing, and they're amazing. They really are.
Well, okay. While we're doing that, there's also an improv group that we're in. So that's there.
Yeah, true. We're having an improv festival that's the first festival up in Alaska, so that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, I've heard about that, too. Okay, but we got to get out of this thing, so we need to say one more time that this event is March 30th and 31st. The times are?
7 o'clock and 9 o'clock on the 30th and 7 o'clock on the 31st.
Charging admission or?
$5 for UAS students and $10 for the general public.
Okay, and 10% of that is going to
V-Day
nationally, and 90% of it is going to our own aware shelter here
in
Juneau.
Correct. Okay, yep.
Ladies, thank you so much for bringing this to us.
Thank
and
you.
And for being there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Harpists are here in town, as a matter of fact. Diana Stork and Portia Diva are here, and they will be doing a concert Saturday night, March 30th, tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m., Northern Light United Church, called The Art of the Harp. So if you like what you hear here, go there and hear more. My next guest is in town after a successful lecture tour around the state, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and now Juneau. But this was a return home because basically we had him here as part of the UAS faculty for quite some period of time. And he is now at Utah Valley University. Is that
correct? That's
right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. And so the reason that has brought Alexander Simon back to Alaska is that he has completed an article and is now doing a series of talks about the sociology and politics, I guess, of behind the attitudes that people have toward wolves, and in particular focusing it on the shooting of the black wolf here in Juneau a couple of years ago, I think. A year ago? 2 years ago?
He was killed in the fall of 2009.
Yeah. Okay. So, little bit back, but a sad moment for a lot of us in the town. Yeah. So it's unusual. I've heard of studies of the sociology of wolves and the sociology of other groups, but the sociology of hunters, I think, is you're plowing fairly new ground.
Yeah, and there certainly are some people who are studying this that area, but it's not a broad subfield. I would have to admit that. But, you know, 15 years ago, no one ever heard of environmental sociology, and so that's certainly a growing subfield.
Environmental sociology. Can you qualify that so
yeah,
we kind
well,
of know what that means?
Oh, okay. So one of the things that I think sociologists have been guilty of in the past is just assuming that the entire world really, or anything worth studying, is socially constructed, but not recognizing that there is such a thing as a physical environment, and that physical environment really affects how we interact. I mean, even if you just look at something really simple, the interactions which occur in Fairbanks are very different in public spaces than occur in Juneau because the climate's so different. So the environment, and that includes other species, they are a significant variable in shaping human history and human interactions.
So how did you you had left Juneau by the or were you in Juneau at the time?
I was in so I left Juneau in 2011, but I arrived in Juneau in 2006, and that I became very familiar with Romeo, and then of course he disappeared, and so that was something I followed very closely, as well as the court case. And then of particular interest to me professionally was the perceptions of people. And so obviously there were many people in the community that really adored the wolf. But then there were others who really had active contempt. And it certainly wasn't just Myers and Peacock. And so I look at their actions as really an extreme manifestation of commonly held sentiments. And so that's what I'm interested in, is why are those out there? What are the historical forces that would explain that?
So how do you gather reflections of people, the attitudes of people?
Yeah, well, more just looking at historical forces. And so that... If you look at the history of human-wolf interactions in North America, they've changed radically. Very briefly, I mean, if we look at indigenous hunters tended to hold wolves in high regard, but that up until probably about the 1950s, Euro-Americans had a lot of contempt and fear for wolves. But that all started to change. So I can remember when I was a kid in the mid-70s, a wolf being brought to my school, and that it was a tame wolf, and petting the wolf and learning that they're really not that much of a threat. And so these things have really changed. And one of the things that historically you can see is when a group, so trophy hunters, that the public perceptions of trophy hunters have really plummeted over the last several decades, where they're not really held in high regard anymore. People don't seem to have much of trouble with hunting for meat, but in particular trophy hunting. But then this inversion where wolves are considered very positively. And so whenever this happens, and it doesn't have to be humans and animals, but where groups that used to be subordinate start to gain status, that causes anger. And so you could see, you know, historically backlashes against African-Americans who were prosperous. Or maybe there's anger that there's an African-American president in the White House, or seeing, I'm assuming it's causing a lot of anxiety among some people that Mark Begich reversed his position on gay marriage recently, and I believe Lisa Murkowski is that. And so what people feel is that the moral order is being threatened, and one way to restore it is to lash out at members of these groups.
Well, let's hope they don't lash out in exactly the same way that the two hunters did with the black wolf.
Right. But you can set up a context, a social context, where you take a group and you demonize it. And this is what I see is reactionary politicians will do this. And so you can just fill in the blank. And so, you know, 200 years ago, it might have been Irishmen to fear, or it could be African-Americans or Jews or whatever. But if you demonize wolves and you demonize wolf advocates, the predictable consequence is that most people aren't going to react, but some will.
So you've now delivered your talk to two other groups of Alaskans, one in the far north and one in Anchorage. Did you observe differences in the way your presentation was received in those two settings?
Well,
now, you did them in academia, in
right?
Both cases, so,
right, yeah. and there's a bit of self-selection that occurs. People who are going to attend university lectures. And so for the most part, I think I was preaching to the choir. Now, one context where I wasn't is I gave a similar talk about a year ago in Casper, Wyoming, and that was at a college, but my colleague Dave Zobe decided to title it "The Problem with Trophy Hunting." And so many trophy hunting guides came to it, and what was interesting, very productive, interesting conversation, is that this one hunting guide said to me, "Well, one thing I agree with you is that many people these days are not interested in a wilderness experience." He said he'll take these people out into the Tetons, this beautiful wilderness area. If they get a trophy bull on their first date, they just want to go home. It's like going to the shopping market for them to just go home. And he found that to be really disturbing. And the other thing he said is younger people aren't hunting anymore. And one thing I should add is I'm a lifelong hunter, and so I do see value in hunting. And that he said that wolves are not. I'm out of business in 10 years because the people just aren't hunting like they used to.
These are really interesting social trends, and I guess I'm wondering. Have you had indication of a wider audience for the things that you're finding in your research?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think this is something that interests the general public quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How's your works in this area being received in academia?
Oh, I think quite well. Huh? Definitely.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so tonight you're doing a talk on this topic at the University of Alaska Southeast, and I think, are you in the lecture hall?
No, in the Egan Library.
In Egan Library, downstairs.
Yes.
Okay, so
yes.
There's room for lots of hunters to attend.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I take it you're not interested in turning any of those folks away from the conversation.
Oh, no. Yeah. But by all means, I think. With any position, with any argument, there are things that people tend to overlook. I include myself in this. There are inconvenient facts to any argument. My hope is some of those will be raised.
Yeah.
I think to have a community conversation about these issues is very important.
Would be very good.
Absolutely.
There may be some people out there who've kind of been waiting to talk about the shooting of our black wolf.
Yes.
2 years ago or 3 years ago. So it's tonight. It's at 7:00. It's in the UAS Egan Library, and our expert is returning after changing or going to another university. Alexander Simon is going to be doing the talk, and you're invited to come out and listen at 7:00 at the Egan Library.
Thank you so much
for coming up and telling us.
Great to be here.
Are Portia Diwa and Diane Stork, and they are playing tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. at the Northern Light United Church, The Art of the Harp. So Just a quick update on the weather forecast. Just popped over the wire here. We have snow and rain developing through late evening with wet snow accumulating to 1 to 2 inches. Lows around 33. Southeast winds, southwest winds, 5 miles per hour, shifting to the southeast in the evening. And then Saturday rain, highs around 43. Southeast winds, 10 miles per hour. You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We're in the middle of our pledge week, and right now you can call 586-3636, 1-800-478-3636 if you're out of town, or go on www.ktoo.org and pledge online. As I said, this is KTOO Juneau. We're on 104.3 FM downtown, but we're also on translators throughout the area to clear our signal. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you get a slightly better signal on 103.1 on K276AF. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek hears us cleanly on 101.7 at K269AO. We put a signal into Gustavus at 88.1 megahertz on K201 AM. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. And we're on GCI Juneau Cable 871 with KRNN on 872, KXLL on 873. And as mentioned previously, we're online at www.ktoo.org, where you can also go right now and pledge your support for KTOO. The show on Monday will be an April Fool's special called National News of the Nation. We'll hear an interview with a 2,000-year-old man. We'll find out about raising chinchillas. We'll hear about one man's struggle with TV addiction. So we'll also have our usual features of Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. That's Monday at 3 on KTOO News. So don't miss Juneau Afternoon on Monday. Pat Morbin, your host today. It's been a great pleasure bringing you interviews with all of these guests. I will be back on Tuesday, and stay tuned now for All Things Considered. Considered.